Hello, it's John Dennis on Wednesday, December the 10th. Today, for sale to the highest bidder, Barack Obama's seat in the US Senate. The governor of Illinois is arrested by the FBI investigating claims of corruption.
And then at one point, he sort of talks about, well, what if he pretends he's going to appoint himself to the Senate seat? That would just help drive up the price.
Also today, a major report shows a huge disparity between child accident rates in poor areas of the UK and those in wealthier parts of the country.
Every year, 830,000 children die from such injuries, which are due to road traffic crashes, burns, drowning, falls, poisoning as the main causes.
And tributes to the late Oliver Postgate, creator of cherished children's TV programmes such as Bagpuss and The Clangers.
Bagpuss, dear Bagpuss, old fat furry catpuss, wake up and look at this thing that I bring.
Dusty looking relics from the golden era of children's television were just scattered around in this barn, and you could pick up Bagpuss and the mortarboard that Bagpuss was awarded that came with an honorary doctorate.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, today's news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
It was a quieter night in Greek cities last night after fresh rioting broke out yesterday. The teenager whose death sparked the uproar when he was shot by police in an Athens suburb was buried yesterday afternoon. Two police officers have been charged in connection with his death. Estimates of the damage caused by 3 days of rioting include 200 shops and 50 banks in Athens. Today, the authorities face an unconnected general strike called by unions in protest against the government's economic policies. British troops will pull out of Iraq by June, as senior military sources told The Guardian. The final withdrawal will begin in March, and most of the 4,000 troops will have left by mid-summer. It's expected about 300 will stay to set up staff colleges for the Iraqi Army and Navy. But the American forces will take over the British headquarters in southern Iraq, based at Basra Airport. That's an agreement with both the Iraqi and US governments, who are concerned about the region's stability. The government will announce stiff restrictions for benefit claimants today. The Work and Pensions Secretary James Purnell will publish a white paper on welfare, which will say benefit claimants will be expected to do some form of work. Only the severely disabled or mothers with babies under 1 year old will be exempt. Everyone else on state support will be expected to look for work or do some community work. Otherwise, they'll have benefits stopped. In the United States, Democratic congressional leaders worked into the night with White House officials and have agreed a bailout for the car industry in principle. It'll mean the companies get a $15 billion loan to carry them over the banking crisis. It still has to be passed by the Senate, but the lower house is controlled by the Democrats. The president-elect, Barack Obama, is preparing a longer-term package of support, which will involve major restructuring of the industry. Football, two English clubs are safely through to the knockout stages of the Champions League. Liverpool didn't need the win, but they firmly defeated PSV Eindhoven 3-1. A winning goal from substitute Didier Drogba took Chelsea to the next stage when they beat Cluj 2-1. And the Chelsea win against a side from Transylvania gives the Sun some fun. Count on Drogula, Didier puts bite on Romanians, is the headline. Other papers are more guarded, pointing out that it was a close-run thing for Chelsea. Drogba ends Chelsea's doubts, says the Times, and sub Drogba plots way through for Chelsea after scare, is the way the Mail puts it. The Mirror also finds another good football story, which proves, it says, that it's a mad, mad world. Juan de Ramos, sacked by Spurs, which he nearly sank, has swiftly become manager of one of the biggest clubs in the world, Real Madrid. Spurs, of course, have had a revival under Ramos's successor, Harry Redknapp. On the front page is controversy over the decision of Sky TV to show a film tonight of a Yorkshireman going through assisted suicide in Switzerland. The Mail says it's shocking. The Mirror asks if this is an insight into the issue of euthanasia or just a cynical attempt to boost ratings. The Independent puts an article by the man's widow, Mary Hewitt, on its front page. She writes, he was keen to have it shown because when death is hidden and private, people don't face their fears about it. All the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Rod Blagojevich, the governor of the state of Illinois, has been arrested on corruption charges. He's been accused of plotting to sell to the highest bidder the seat in the US Senate left vacant by Barack Obama. Suzanne Goldenberg is in The Guardian's Washington office with the details.
Well, it's quite astonishing, really. He's being accused of trying to sell Barack Obama's seat in the Senate. Under Illinois law, the state's governor, Rod Blagojevich, is the only person authorized to appoint someone to the seat to fill out the remainder of Obama's term.
I mean, that is quite an astonishing allegation. What's the evidence against him?
It's absolutely staggering, but the FBI had been tapping his phone for about a month, and they've recorded various conversations between Blagojevich and other people about selling the Senate seat. I mean, this is something he discussed often and at great length, and he tried out various scenarios, trying to see how much money he could get for the seat, whether he could get a job for himself or a place on a corporation board for his wife, whether he should take a payment up front, about $500,000, or a job, you know, with a salary of $250,000 a year. And then at one point, he sort of talks about, well, what if he pretends he's going to appoint himself to the Senate seat? That would just help drive up the price.
And there are also allegations that he tried to use the allocation of state funds in order to influence the editorial of the Chicago Tribune, which is facing financial trouble at the moment.
Absolutely. On the grand scheme of things, the allegations involving the Chicago Tribune are pretty minor. He wanted to get certain members of the editorial board who had written critically about him sacked from their jobs. But this is a man who, according to the FBI charge sheet against him, you know, demanded that a children's hospital give him $50,000 for his campaign fund. When they did not agree, he then tried to hold up $8 million in state funds for this children's hospital. He also tried to extort money from contractors for $1.8 billion highway scheme. So he had been under investigation for some time on a number of different corruption schemes, but the FBI felt they had to move very quickly on this one to sell Obama's Senate seat because they were afraid, quite simply, that he would go ahead with the deal.
Is there any connection between the allegations facing Governor Blagojevich and Barack Obama himself?
They've been very clear at a press conference yesterday when the charges were first announced that Obama has nothing whatsoever to do with this scheme and, you know, had no idea that it was going on.
Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. And there's more on that story today at guardian.co.uk/America. Also on The Guardian's website, Nick Clegg, leader of the Liberal Democrats, argues that freedom in the UK has taken a battering under New Labour. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Billy Bragg discusses the healing properties of music. He helped start the Jail Guitar Doors scheme, which takes musical instruments into prisons. He says it's been popular with inmates and it's helped reduce reoffending rates. SocietyGuardian.co.uk has video of that. And John Henley on the environmental activists Plain Stupid. Are they just a bunch of posh kids, he asks, at guardian.co.uk/G2. Child injury rates in the poorest parts of the UK are as high as those in Kazakhstan. That's according to a report today from the World Health Organization. It says that in the world as a whole, more than 2,000 children die every day in accidents, and at least half of those could have been preventable. Dr. Etienne Krug is director of the organization's Department of Violence and Injury Prevention and Disability.
Well, the report looked at childhood unintentional injuries all over the world, and it shows that every year 830,000 children die from such injuries, which are due to road traffic crashes, burns, drowning, falls, poisoning as the main causes. This means like 2,270 kids are dying every day. It shows also that once a child reaches the age of 9, unintentional injuries becomes the leading cause of death. So we have seen now an improvement in a lot of other health conditions, but childhood injuries have become a very important cause of death all over the world. And it shouldn't be like that, because we know what to do and we could save 1,000 lives a day if we did implement the known interventions.
What interventions in particular would be sort of relatively easy to implement?
Well, the problem is that we are still very often designing the environment in which children evolve, grow, and transport themselves and play for adults. And children are not little adults. So what we have to do is conceive our society, conceive our homes, conceive our streets, also to be appropriate for children so that they can have their own needs fulfilled in terms of discovering the world, in terms of playing, and in terms of sometimes taking risks, as boys often tend to do. So there's a number of things that can be done in all of these different areas. In road traffic injuries, they're well known, seat belts, child restraints, not drinking and driving or speeding, smoke alarms for burns, fencing swimming pools or water areas, covering wells in the developing world. And these are quite well-known interventions, and in countries like Britain, they're very much implemented already. But in most of the rest of the world, and particularly in the lower and middle-income countries, this is far from being done.
What's Britain's safety record like?
Britain ranks among the safest countries for injuries in the world. It has a very good record. It has implemented a large number of road traffic prevention interventions, as well as drowning or burn prevention interventions or poisoning prevention interventions. So there are a number of very good steps that have been taken in the UK, and the rates of death among children have decreased considerably. Having said that, the UK can still do better. It still has a rate that's about 20% higher than the Netherlands, for example. And also, what's important to notice is that people in poorer areas or in poorer families are at much higher risk than those in more affluent areas because they don't benefit so much from prevention efforts. They live often in higher risk environments, and when they are affected by an injury, they often have less easy access to quality health services. And therefore, although the rate in the UK is very good, in some parts of society, the rates could still be improved quite a bit more. There are many countries in the world that the poorest parts of the British society could be compared to. Some have said that the rate of childhood injuries in the poorest parts of Britain compared to rates in Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan.
Etienne Krug from the World Health Organization. I'm John Dennis, still to come on Guardian Daily. As ministers in Poznan discuss how to tackle global warming, we'll hear from Brazil on how climate change directly affects the lives of people in the developing world.
Steadily, the drought bites harder and harder and things get drier and drier. You can see a couple of reservoirs that are doing well this year because we had a good rainy season.
But it's not always like that.
Oh no, we've seen that completely dried up. And our third reserve reservoir, which is out of sight, dried up too, so it gets pretty scary.
But first, at the summit on climate change in Poznan, European officials have offered to make the continent virtually carbon free. It's an attempt to get China and other developing countries to agree on a new global climate deal to replace the Kyoto Protocol. That's according to Stavros Dimas, the European Commissioner for the Environment, who's been speaking to The Guardian. Environment correspondent David Adam told Guardian Daily's Matt Wells about the plan.
The EU at present has a target for 2050 of reducing carbon emissions 60 to 80%. Now, when I went to see Stavros Dimas a week or so ago, he's the European Commissioner for the Environment, he's in charge of this kind of thing in Brussels, he said to me that the EU was going to raise that 2050 target to 80 to 95%. Reduction in carbon levels.
What we have right now is the targets that we have set for midterm of 30%, 20%. Of course, in case that in Copenhagen, because of the scientific evidence, we could agree at a higher percentage of reductions, Europe wouldn't be the one to deny it. About the longer term reductions is still being discussed.
Stavros Dimas there. What are the implications of what he's saying, David? Because it's my understanding that the current targets, even of 60 to 80%, are already looking rather unachievable.
Yeah, I think 2050 is a very convenient timescale for politicians because number one, they're not going to be around to be held accountable. And number two, it's just far enough away they can say there's going to be a big change in technology. And when it comes to climate change, the change in technology is usually carbon capture and storage. This idea that all of the coal-fired power stations will be able to trap all of their emissions and put them under the ground so they won't do any damage. Politically, it's quite an interesting time for him to say this, because later this week, the European leaders are still trying to agree the European targets that were announced or agreed sort of a year ago to reduce carbon 20% by 2020. And many member states are saying that's impossible. It's too expensive.
And presumably, as well, we're talking about the European side of things, but there's got to be some kind of quid pro quo in regard to the developing world as well. What's he had to say about that?
Well, yeah, he also said, this is very interesting, because people have talked about the developing world taking on some kind of, they don't say targets, they sometimes say commitments, because the developing world would run a mile if we said to them, you need to reduce your emissions by a certain amount, because they would say, well, hang on a minute, this is your problem. You said you were going to reduce your emissions. You haven't done it. You know, you do something first. Why on earth should we take any action? But what Stavros Dimas also said was that he'd put on the table proposals or suggestions or even just ideas that the developing world could not reduce its emissions in absolute terms. So it wouldn't produce less carbon that Europe is pledging to do, but it could just sort of reduce the rate at which it increases its carbon. And that's called, it's called business as usual, essentially. If you assume, I don't know, that the carbon rate's going to go up by 10% a year, he's saying, well, look, maybe you make it 8 or 7% a year. And so he has he's suggested the figures 15 to 30% against businesses or below business as usual by what he calls the midterm, which is 2020.
David Adam talking to Matt Wells. Well, at the UN negotiations on a global climate deal in Poznan this week, rich countries are arguing the case for global carbon trading. They want financial markets to tackle and to profit from climate change. But the world's poorest nations suffer disproportionately from the damage caused by global warming. Our environment editor, John Vidal, reports from Imaculada in northeast Brazil on the effects of a changing climate.
Some communities are adapting to climate change better than others. They're the ones which can afford to put in the wells, they're the ones which can drill deeper to find the water and survive. And I'm in this community here now, where 15 years ago they saw the need for water, they saw the need for radical change in how they live. They petitioned government, they went to government, they said, we need water, we need wells. And they insisted on it, and they got it. And since then, their life has absolutely changed. They're now one of the most prosperous communities in the whole of this drought-ridden area. And they're teaching other communities how to go to government and say, no, we have a right to water. We can defeat climate change by sustainable development. And the old methods of development are still just as relevant for adapting to climate change as the new ones. Pastor John, we're on a high hill overlooking vast area northeast Brazil. Tell us what you see.
Well, you can see the plain of Patos, all dried up as always at this time of year. Steadily the drought bites harder and harder and things get drier and drier. You can see a couple of reservoirs that are doing well this year because we had a good rainy season at the beginning of the year. So the Jatobá reservoir to the left and the Farinha reservoir over there to the right, plenty of water this year.
But it's not always like that.
Oh no, we've seen that completely dried up. And our third reserve reservoir, which is out of sight, dried up too. So it gets pretty scary because obviously you can ship water in by, lorries if you're necessary for small towns and small villages. But for 100,000 population, you'd be having the tanker lorries crashing into each other to deliver water, sort of thing. So it got really scary in some years when, you know, all this dried up completely.
Yolanda Gomez is just 16, but her father has abandoned the family of 11 children, and she now has to get up at 2:30 every morning to collect water.
It's a very big problem because we have to walk so much. It's too far, and we need water for animals, we need water for us. It's very difficult.
So you need a lot of water every day. How often do you go to collect the water?
Duas, três vezes, porque
Every day we need to get water to cook, to take a shower, and for the animals too.
Lyndon Carlos is a well maker. He works for ASEV, which is funded by Tier Fund. He says it's getting worse. A variação da chuva tem aumentado.
Sometimes the rain comes in different months. It varies a lot. Sometimes it comes very heavy, and sometimes not so heavy. It's very sporadic.
João Silva is 19, and this year it looks certain that he'll have to leave his family and go to the south with thousands of others to earn a bit of money. He's very distressed.
I'm thinking about it, because when it's a good year, you can get water. But if not, you have to walk maybe 3 kilometers to get water. It's very bad. Others are leaving too.
The message is pretty clear. Work with nature and there's a chance of adapting, even turning back climate change. Farm in the old ways and there will not be enough water. And millions of people living in the driest parts of the world will have to abandon the land.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Some of the best-loved children's television programmes ever, Bagpuss, The Clangers, Noggin the Nog and Ivor the Engine, were created and narrated by Oliver Postgate, who's died at a nursing home in Kent, aged 83.
Bagpuss, dear Bagpuss, old fat furry catpuss, wake up and look at this thing that I bring. Wake up, be bright, be golden and light. Bagpuss, oh hear what I sing.
Oliver Postgate had a real sense of childlike wonder about him, and that really was communicated in his work. He thought of objects coming to life as they did in Bagpuss, or trains with personalities as they did in Ivor the Engine. There was just a real sense of that kind of wonder at the world.
The mice on the mouse organ woke up and stretched. Madeleine the rag doll. Gabriel the toad.
Oh, look, look.
Well, I found there was a slightly sad, melancholic tinge to it, not least in the theme music and the sepia-tinged photographs with which each episode would begin. And also the whole concept of the show, which was based around a shop which didn't sell anything.
And last of all, Professor Yaffle, who is a very distinguished old woodpecker. He climbed down off his bookend and went to see what it was that Emily had brought.
They were very simply expressed stories, but there was always a sophistication of ideas in them, and they were always usually from a socialist point of view, and I found that very appealing indeed, particularly now with hindsight. I can make my children watch them in a lecturing, middle-class way.
Yeah. Well, it's quite obvious what that is. That is one dirty old shoe without any laces. Whatever is the use of one shoe? You can't do anything with it.
Oh, yes, you can. You can do something with it. Old shoes are good shoes.
Oliver Postgate helped define children's TV in the 60s and 70s with highly individual shows that he made for Small Films, the company that he formed in the 1950s with the artist and puppeteer Peter Firmin. Among the many people paying tribute to Postgate is broadcaster Peter Curran, who made a radio programme about him for the BBC.
I think one of the great things that Oliver Postgate brought to television was a kind of sense of colour and a believable alternative universe for children. You know, previously, the sort of kids' programmes that were put before children had an element of parental instruction about them. There was a kind of, you know, moral or lifestyle guidance for the under fives. Whereas he came along and he did believable fantasy programs for kids that very much existed on their own terms and didn't need an adult sitting alongside approving of what was coming down the cathode ray tube. So I think he was one of those people who very much stayed true to his belief that children's programs should be for children.
You made a radio program about Postgate and his work. What was he like as a man?
Very generous and had this nice, open, kind of slightly bumbling nature, which belied a fairly sophisticated political mind. I mean, he came from quite a highbrow Labour Party supporting family, but he himself had this great kind of old school, slightly patrician warmth to him. And he was just, and everything he could do to help was kind of laid out before you. I went down to his house in Canterbury, and he kind of led me across this fence to his next-door neighbour, Peter Furman, who created all the models for Bagpuss and the Clangers and so forth. And they had the whole thing stored in this old barn affair, and these kind of historic slightly dusty-looking relics from the golden era of children's television were just scattered around in this barn, and you could pick up Bagpuss and, you know, the mortarboard that Bagpuss was awarded that came with an honorary doctorate that he was given. But he was just a very generous, open mind, had a twinkle in his eye, and quite serious political views in terms of his pacifism, which he was imprisoned for when he was a young man and objected to national service. So he had a nice kind of mixture of playfulness, but quite a serious thinker behind it all.
He was quite bitter, though, wasn't he, about the way he'd been treated by the BBC?
Who isn't? I think the thing about Oliver Postgate and Peter Furman, his collaborator, was whether it was the BBC or ITV, they always struggled to get a decent budget to kind of realise his dreams, you know, to bring these fantastic creations to life. And so he was quite bitter because he set the amount of money, the meagre amount of money he was given to make his programmes, alongside the vast popularity they enjoyed with people. And there just seemed to be a terrible disparity between that. And it was almost, I think he felt that the only reason that they gave him so little money was because he would have almost made the programmes himself for his own amusement because he cared so passionately about them. And he wasn't the sort of person to stamp his feet and, bang the door off of its hinges if he didn't get the right amount of money. And it was only kind of later in life. I mean, the time that I was having a lot of regular contact with him, he was still very much on his uppers. But in his latter years, he did manage to secure a good licensing deal, and he started to enjoy some of the considerable profits from merchandising, video and DVD sales.
Peter Curran on Oliver Postgate. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.